Hello and welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll look into a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with an analysis of whether there will be a real change in our national security establishment that is so bloated and expensive that it's becoming a threat to America's economic health and security. A former National Security Council senior staffer for two presidents, Roger Morris, joins us to assess whether Chuck Hagel will be able to reform the Pentagon in the face of the shrill opposition from neoconservative shills for the military-industrial complex. Then we'll examine further Hagel's chances of being confirmed as Secretary of Defense, with many of his former Republican Senate colleagues leading the charge against him. Former Assistant Secretary of Defense Lawrence Korb joins us to discuss the forces arrayed against Hagel and the growing number of former senior military, diplomatic, and national security officials coming forward to support his nomination. Then finally, following the announcement today that President Hugo Chavez will not attend his own inauguration in Venezuela on Thursday, we will speak with Jennifer McCoy, who is the director of the Carter Center's Americas program, who has conducted election monitoring in Venezuela and is the author of The Unraveling of Representative Democracy in Venezuela. We will discuss the growing constitutional dispute between the government and the opposition, whose leader said today, "There is no monarchy here, and we aren't in Cuba." Joining us now is Roger Morris, who served in the United States Foreign Service and on the senior staff of the National Security Council under both Presidents Lyndon Johnson and Richard Nixon until resigning over the invasion of Cambodia. His latest book, Between the Graves, is about the history of the U.S.-Afghan relations and of America's policy in South Asia based on thousands of previously secret documents. He's also at work on a comparative history of the inner politics of the United States and Soviet Russia. Welcome to Background Briefing, Roger Morris.
Thank you, Ian.
And Roger, we spoke recently and you were skeptical that that President Obama would stand up for the Hagel nomination and stand his ground as instead of folding as he did with Susan Rice. He's obviously taking on a fight here.
Well, I think he is, and I'm always surprised, I must say, when this president stands his ground. We don't have a lot of precedent for that, as you know. We can only hope a second term will be different. But I do think this controversy is already overblown, and of course we're not into the hearings yet, but as Tallulah Bankhead once said about a Broadway play, there's less here, I think, than meets the eye. This is a definitely conservative former Republican senator. Chuck Hagel voted for the Patriot Act. He never really met a defense budget he didn't like in his 12 years in the Senate. He voted in October 22 for the Iraq War resolution. And you remember, Ian, well, that there were 23 senators, as well as a number of other political figures opposed to that resolution. So he was a firm and largely unconditional supporter of the Bush administration. I remember quite well, he voted for the Bush tax cuts in 2001 and 2003, the price of which we're paying now in so many different ways. He voted against McCain-Feingold and quite was an unconditional and unquestioning supporter of Israel during all of those years, which makes, of course, the questioning of his stance toward Israel somewhat ironic at this point. This is this was a Reagan Republican who got his start, after all, as a young Reagan organizer in Nebraska, went off to work for the Veterans Administration and then left in a policy difference, but went back with Reagan connections to make a private fortune, founding Vanguard Cellular, and eventually moving into the McCarthy Investment Banking outfit in Nebraska, and owning many of the of the voting machines that we still use today. They were a subsidiary of McCarthy, and you may remember there was controversy after his election in '96 to the Senate, and then again in 2002 about whether those voting machines might have influenced his winning margins. This is not a virginal, innocent, sort of late life liberal that we're looking at here, though the right wing, of course, tends to paint him that way. This is part of the problem of an atmosphere, a climate that is so sterile, so frozen, so perverse, really, in foreign policy terms that even Chuck Hagel can look like a rescuing progressive. The one thing I must say, which I think is encouraging, is that his change of heart after 2006, 2007, after it became rather painfully obvious that the Iraq War was a disaster, his change of heart there, his tendency to question later on again in his career the undying devotion to Israeli policy, to the Likud, rather than any kind of objective appraisal of American interests, that promises again in this very sterile and frozen atmosphere, perhaps some at least warm breath of change in the Obama administration. A Secretary of Defense, as you well know, can frame much of the agenda that comes to the president. He can frame part of the intelligence, although Hagel will have a rather serious rival in any effort to move off the dime here in John Brennan, the new nominee for the director of the Central Intelligence Agency.
So, Roger Morris, yesterday I spoke with John Judas, who did a profile of Chuck Hagel for the New Republic back in 2007.
Yes.
And he pointed out that when he was he got his Purple Heart, so one of his Purple Hearts, for rescuing his own brother. They were both blown up in a armored personnel carrier that caught on fire, and the ammunition cooked off, and he managed to get his brother out. And his brother Tom, apparently, after the Vietnam War, went into a depression and felt that the war was immoral, and that his role in the war was immoral, and for the people that were killed and the lives that were wasted. And he became a sort of liberal law professor and a liberal Democrat, and always opposed the war. And whereas his older brother Chuck stood by it, and then later, when the tape was released of Lyndon Johnson, your the president that you once served, talking with Richard Russell about his doubts about the Vietnam War and about him sending the sergeant off to die, and he didn't even know what the hell the war was about, yet he felt that he was compelled to continue digging the hole deeper, that had a profound effect on Hagel. And then finally, during the Iraq War, he studied up on Vietnam and finally came to his brother's conclusion that the war was immoral because the political leaders had lied their way into these wars, both Iraq and Vietnam, and essentially the soldiers, like him and his brother, were just meat for the grinder for the political ambitions and cowardice of others.
You know, I think there is a class element in all of this, Ian. This is the first enlisted man, veteran of the Vietnam War, who will be Secretary of Defense, and I do think he'll be confirmed. I think Judas's piece was wonderful. It talked about the emotional impact of the war on Hagel. His conversion took a while, but I don't think we should doubt it. I think that there's every evidence that what he learned about the war in Iraq, and for that matter, the war in Afghanistan, was solid, and the evidence turned him against those enterprises. He really did challenge his own party and the prevailing orthodoxy of the surge and all the rest. He was a team player, but not a rote team player. And when he made, of course, his break with the orthodoxy of the Bush administration, that's when the wrath of the neocons and of the right wing came down on him. It was never really for any kind of major break on support of Israel or the defense budget, for that matter, or defense spending. It was all about the folly, the blunder, the tragedy of American involvement in Iraq.
Again, I'm speaking with Roger Morris, who served on the United States Foreign Service and on the senior staff of the National Security Council under both Presidents Lyndon Johnson and Richard Nixon until resigning over the invasion of Cambodia. His latest book, Between the Graves, is about the history of U.S.-Afghan relations and American policy in South Asia, based on thousands of previously secret documents. Now, just to digress a little bit because of your book on Between the Graves on on Afghanistan. You know, Karzai has just shown up in Washington, and I guess the White House, as a gambit, have floated the idea that maybe they won't leave anybody behind in Afghanistan, because obviously Karzai is there to soak as much money out of the Americans as he can, and that's basically what's been going on.
This is a time-honored technique, Ian. You may remember that the Soviets experienced this when they first began to talk seriously with the then leftist government in Kabul and in 1987-88, and finally left at the beginning of 89, and left behind, of course, not combat troops, but a very, very major aid investment, and I'm sure Karzai is counting on that at the very least. But this is a matter of separation anxiety for both sides. Certainly, Obama doesn't want to leave a disaster in his wake, and Karzai would like to preserve this. It's still shaky, but nonetheless, real power of the Kabul oligarchy, which he represents. So these are substantial dances in the minuet.
Well, I've talked to a specialist on Afghanistan and Pakistan who actually speaks all the local languages and worked there with the United Nations, and she describes the Karzai regime as a narco-kleptocracy, and that they basically have been parking all their money in the Gulf, and that a lot of that money, if not most of it, is U.S. taxpayer money.
Well, absolutely. I think when the final history, documented history of this war comes to be written, it will be perhaps, and this is really quite a distinction given Vietnam and all the rest, the most corrupt war in American history. There's no question that a lot of that money has been expatriated and it awaits the last flights out of Kabul, which we will inevitably see. How the United States handles that, how it justifies it, what regime we'll have in Washington, of course, God only knows. But that's only a matter of time after the Americans exit. What regime takes power is by no means clear, because it's not going to be this simplistic Taliban that is the demon of the American media and the rather all too simple image of the American public.
So there's a flare-up in Kashmir at the moment. There have been some cross-border incursions, and a Pakistani soldier was killed a few days ago, and then two Indian soldiers were killed yesterday. And I recall that when the special envoy to the White House, that Obama appointed Richard Holbrooke as his special envoy, the first thing that Holbrooke wanted to do was to take on the Kashmir portfolio, on the basis that if you can solve the Kashmir problem, which is certainly easy to solve, or should be easy to solve, then that takes away a lot of the tension between India and Pakistan and takes away a lot of the justification for the Pakistani military to dominate their politics. He apparently got nowhere, Holbrooke, because the Indian lobby, which has modeled itself on the Israeli lobby in Washington, D.C., basically scuttled the deal. Is there any reason to be concerned about this latest flare-up in Kashmir? And is there any way that this ridiculous battle between people that are literally at 20,000 feet, they can barely breathe the air and they're shooting at each other?
Well, this is, of course, one of the long-standing running sores in American foreign policy. That issue should have been solved a long time ago, and we had a great deal more leverage with both governments. It's not just the Indian lobby, although that's a very, very substantial force, and you're quite right. It has modeled itself on the pro-Israel lobby in Washington, which has been, after all, a precedent and a model for a number of these groups. But it's also the American military. Long-standing relationship with Pakistan. I mean, the two sides here are thoroughly corrupted by the vested interests. Holbrooke, I think, had the right idea, but was unable and not even be able to start, really, to implement that under the Obama administration. And the White House had surrendered very early on to the Pentagon and to the military in Afghanistan. Holbrooke was never able to make up that distance. And I find it ironic now that we have all this praise, all this public praise for Hillary Rodham Clinton as such a successful Secretary of State. My goodness, I think her chief distinction is would be her frequent flyer miles. She failed utterly to grasp the AFPAC problem, she and Holbrook together. And by the time anyone got around to really seriously analyzing that, the issue was moot. I think Hagel will face, ironically, now as Secretary of Defense, what he only glimpsed as a sergeant, as a squad leader in Vietnam, and that's the agony of an orderly withdrawal from a war which is a rather ignominious defeat. He's not one of the many fathers or mothers of that defeat, but he certainly will have to preside over the management of it.
And Roger Morris, again, served on the National Security Councils under both President Lyndon Johnson and Richard Nixon until resigning over the invasion of Cambodia. His latest book is Between the Graves, about the history of U.S.-Afghan relations and American policy in South Asia, based on thousands of previously secret documents. The premise, though, of my introduction to the program today and to you is there a possibility of a real change in our national security establishment that is so bloated and expensive that it's becoming a threat to America's economic health and security? Hagel himself has said the defense budget is bloated. So is there any reason to believe that this absolutely ridiculous situation where the U.S. outspends almost all of the world combined and all of its enemies, potential, real, imagined, whatever, tenfold or a hundredfold or whatever? I mean, we're literally fighting a bunch of irregulars. We're not fighting the Soviet Union that could, within 20 minutes, wipe out the entire United States.
Well, I think there's hope, Ian, if this is the condition that underlies all of this, if indeed there is a second administration Obama, unlike the first administration's president. These are going to be decisions that Obama will make, I think in part, of course, for political expedience, but certainly in large measure also for his own legacy. The defense budget is the popular and natural target. This has got to be one of the first priorities. If Medicare is the last priority for the cuts, the defense budget has got to be the first. And one can only hope that Hagel will bring that tough squad leader sergeant's view that there is an enormous amount of fat and waste and corruption. The military-industrial complex relationship with the Pentagon, of course, is one of the great old and enduring scandals in Washington. To get hold of that would be a major historic act by Hagel. But he faces a much more formidable opposition than any previous defense secretary has. It's gotten worse and worse and worse. This drone lobby is enormous. It's not just, this is the legacy of 9/11, it's not just the Pentagon or the military-industrial world. It is this whole new intelligence empire, what I would call the irregulars, led by the CIA and their paramilitary presence, and all of the contractors who now crowd Northern Virginia and the Maryland suburbs of Washington in proportions and with influence and magnitude and wealth and power in the Congress never before seen in Washington. This is a new world. It's the post 9/11 world. So to talk merely about cutting the defense budget or recalibrating American foreign policy and getting control of this national security monster is by no means simply a matter of it was never simple, but it was enormously difficult. But simply a matter of the Pentagon itself. It is three or four or five times larger and more formidable than anything any of us who were in government in the 60s or 70s ever faced, or even for that matter, dreamt of.
Well, it's interesting that you should say that, Roger Morris, because in that secret tape that Bob Woodward revealed of Fox News soliciting Petraeus to become president of the United States, with Murdoch financing the campaign and Roger Ailes running the campaign, what Petraeus said there was that he didn't want to be the chairman of the Joint Chiefs, not that he would ever be offered that, but he said that he really thought that the job as head of the CIA would be the best job to have, because that's where all the action's going to be. That's where the future of warfare will be. So Petraeus saw what you're talking about.
I think he did, and you know, it's ironic, Ian, we've got a discussion now about Brennan, the new director of the CIA, or the nominee, making a shift from his policy-making role. I heard this today in a broadcast. Shifting from his policy-making role in the White House as the counterterrorism resident expert to director of the CIA, where he will only be processing information and not making policy. That, of course, is absurd. This is a policy-making organization, more powerful than it ever has been before, and it's always been very powerful indeed. This is a huge, it's quite apt to call it, as you did, the national security establishment, because it's much more than just the uniform military, much more than just the weapons makers and the purveyors and traders and all the rest. It is now a vast political and bureaucratic presence in Washington, and their call for, of course, on Capitol Hill and in the White House.
Well, the extraordinary thing is, as bad as what you're talking about, the new drone lobby and all of the contractors up there at Tyson's Corner, the other part of it, which is actually the legacy of Bill Perry and these Democratic defense intellectual, is this massive fraud known as stealth. And this F-35, which is the largest military contract in the history of mankind, is producing a totally useless airplane, as is the F-22, a useless airplane. And the Russians sell a radar for $10 million that can pick up these planes.
Yeah.
And I talked to the designer of the A-10 and the F-16 the other day, and he's tearing his hair out, Pierre Spray, you know, that the plane, this F-35, is replacing the F-16 that he designed, and the F-16 outperforms this aircraft in every category.
And you're absolutely right. This is a bipartisan disaster and has been for a long time. And people talked about alternatives to Hagel to avoid the controversy. Someone like Michelle Coyne, who's a longtime advocate of these programs. And I mean, this is Michelle Flournoy. I said Coyne.
Yeah, the queen of Coyne, she's called. Yeah.
She is Ms. Coyne in the Pentagon, the counterinsurgency strategy. The Democrats have been as ardent and, in their own way, as corrupt in these matters as the Republicans. It's not an accident that we have never had a serious debate about national security strategy, let alone significant or meaningful reform of the Pentagon or of the intelligence establishment.
Well, just in closing, Roger Morris, is there any chance that the American public will demand more from the Pentagon? I mean, here we are wasting trillions of dollars on useless airplanes to fight the Cold War, and they don't even work. I mean, it's bad enough to waste money, but at least you ought to be able to produce something at the end of the day that you can use. And it's so obscene that it's laughable.
I despair of that, Ian, simply because I don't think anyone of any stature left in the Democratic Party is sufficiently versed in this or politically courageous enough to take it on. Someone like Barney Frank, who spent a long time looking at these issues and knew something about the Pentagon budget, can leave the Congress and can frame a critique. But you don't have anyone, and at least of all the heir or heiress apparent for the presidency in 2016, who's in a position to even understand how this world works and its magnitude, the difficulty, and the details. The devil here is always in the details. And this is perhaps the single most urgent and decisive problem facing a new administration. And of course, it will get, I think, only short shrift.
Well, I thank you so much for joining us here today, Roger Morris.
Thank you.
Again, I've been speaking with Roger Morris, who served on the National Security Council under Presidents Johnson and Nixon until resigning over the invasion of Cambodia. His latest book is Between the Graves, which is about the history of U.S.-Afghan relations and American policy in South Asia based on thousands of previously secret documents. We're going to take a brief station break, and we'll be back talking with the former Assistant Secretary of Defense about Hagel's chances of being confirmed.
Changes. Don't tell them to grow up on high.